Kenosha, Wisconsin at 91.1 on your FM dial and 101.7 in Elkhorn and 103.3 in Lake Geneva. WGTD is a member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Network. Our program today focuses on current professional issues in Wisconsin public education, with particular emphasis on urban education as found in Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine. My guest today is Dr. Tony Frontier, Assistant Professor of Education at Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee. Tony is a native of Racine, and thus he has a good sense of urban education today from having grown up with it and having worked in and near Wisconsin urban education. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
And let me apologize, too, just in case there's some noise in the background. There are some facilities construction here at Gateway in Kenosha. They are putting in some nursing facilities to resemble a hospital, and so we shall anticipate that it will be quiet, but we do not know. So, okay, to get us started today, Dr. Frontier, tell our listeners a little about your own education.
Sure. I grew up in Racine and went to Racine Unified Schools. I went to the Stephen Bull Fine Arts School as a kid and in Mitchell Middle School and went on to St. Cat's from there. But my higher education, I was one of those students who entered university knowing I wanted to do many things, but not which specifically. So I got undergrad degrees in sociology and journalism. Minor in history at UW-Milwaukee, did my post-bac education certification coursework at Marquette University. Then from there, went to Cardinal Stritch University for my master's in educational leadership and my PhD in leadership for the advancement of learning and service at Stritch as well.
So that pretty well takes care of it. Well, congratulations. The nice thing I think about having a broad background is educators need to have a broad background. So it's a rich background that they bring working with the students that they educate.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, congratulations on that. So what motivated you to become an educator? Tell us about your professional background that has brought you to Cardinal Stritch today.
Yeah. So I knew I wanted to teach. I was interested in many different disciplines, just always curious. So I taught in Milwaukee Public Schools and Roosevelt Middle School of the Arts. I have an arts background in music and photography and was able to dovetail those experiences into my teaching at Roosevelt. From there, I was associate principal at Whitefish Bay High School for a few years, and I was curriculum director for the school district of Whitefish Bay for just about 10 years.
Really?
Yeah. And after I'd finished up my doctoral degree, was feeling the need to go back and do more teaching and really wanted to have the opportunity to do more research and writing and see schools around the world. And Cardinal Stritch has been a fantastic place for me to spread my wings and explore those possibilities and work with great colleagues and students along the way.
Wonderful. Let's back up and talk a little bit about being a curriculum director, because that certainly is a very responsible position in a school district, because curriculum is what schools purvey.
Yes, exactly. And when I did my work as a curriculum director, people would always ask me when I was going to become a superintendent. And, and my response was always, I went into this field because of a passion for teaching and a passion for learning and a passion for inquiry. And the curriculum director position really allows one the opportunity to exercise leadership in that area. And bless the people who aspire to the superintendency because there are some complex issues that need to be tended to behind the scenes to make sure schools work. But I prefer to keep my focus solely on matters of teaching and learning.
And what goes on in the classroom then, and how kids learn,
et cetera,
and then teachers, of course, then purvey that learning.
Absolutely.
Organize that sort of thing. Okay. You already have four co-authored education books published by the Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development, ASCD, for those in education. the most prominent organization dealing with K-12 school curriculum in the United States. And let me also mention that some of your books are published in other languages, which I find incredible and wonderful. Let's talk about your first book, Five Levers to Improve Learning, How to Prioritize for Powerful Results in Your School, co-authored with James Rickabaugh. What about student learning motivated that book?
Yeah, and that's the first book that I was lead author. I had the opportunity my first book to write with Bob Marzano and David Livingston on effective supervision, supporting the art and science of teaching. And Bob Marzano, very prominent name in the field, and really in my opinion the top mind in bringing research to practice. And had the opportunity to meet him through my work at Cardinal Stritch, and we've formed a friendship and a professional partnership since then. So that was my initial orientation to doing work with ASCD, which is just a phenomenal organization. So the Five Levers to Improve Learning book, wrote that with Jim Rickabaugh, and Jim was a superintendent in Whitefish Bay and another mentor of mine. And in our work together, we noticed some patterns, not only within our own school district, but in districts around the country where we'd had the opportunity to do work. And the essence of the pattern that we noted was that you can really take all of educational research and all of educational practice and boil it down to five areas. You have structural components, things like school size and class size and choice and charter. You've got the sample of students, which kids go where, grouping practices, who has access to support services, who has access to programs that require more challenge. You've got standards. What are our expectations for learning, and what are our expectations for quality? You've got strategy. What are the practices that teachers utilize in the classroom to build students' capacity to achieve standards? And then the final component is self. And self is really what do teachers believe to be true about their capacity to teach kids, and what do kids believe to be true about their capacity to learn. So if you think about those five components then, structure, sample, strategy, standards, and self, the challenge is the most obvious, the most visible levers are really those around structure and sample. The conundrum is this. The approaches that we take to change schools are often the least efficient and least effective at changing students' learning experiences.
Say that again.
Yep. The changes we make that are most efficient in changing schools are often the least effective in changing student learning experiences. And here's how that can manifest itself. We can get hung up on finding, you know, silver bullets.
Yes.
Things like block schedules, for example, or redrawing district boundaries, choice and charter, year-round schools. Those are all really big levers that we attempt to pull. They generate a lot of conversation.
Yes.
They are feathers in the caps of people who can make those changes. The challenge, though, is if you look at the research base around a lot of those changes, the net effect is zero.
Yep.
They don't matter. They don't matter in terms of student learning. Now, there certainly may be times when those types of decisions need to be made to create fiscal efficiencies and so on. But if you tell me about a school that is it's a choice or a charter school, and it is a smaller school, and they have some gender-separated classes and kids wearing uniforms, and I can't tell you anything about student learning in that school. None of those factors allow me to predict anything about student achievement. But these tend to be the areas that we gravitate toward in public discourse and discussion and debate about how to improve schools. The opportunity exists in how do we utilize strategies?
Yes.
How do we utilize instructional strategies to connect kids' conceptions of themselves as learners to standards? So at the point of contact between a teacher and child, it really doesn't matter if I'm in an open educational environment or if I'm in a room with 12 kids or 30 kids.
Or uniforms or whatever.
Yeah, all those pieces. What really matters is, does the child understand where he or she is currently in his or her learning? Does the child understand what the goal is?
Yes.
And does the teacher have a strategy to move the child from point A to point B? And even more powerfully, is the child internalizing strategies to move from point A to point B? So when we look at these three levers of standard, strategy, and self, now we get into conversations and discourse around quality assessment, quality feedback for learners, helping kids develop skills where they can engage in goal-setting practices, helping to acknowledge that there are some kids who, by the end of first grade, they've decided they're not very smart, and school is not a game that they can play
And succeed.
So how do we intervene for those kids and delve into things like growth mindset and some of the research on expertise? And too often kids think the school is a place where you go and give right answers to questions that you already knew the answers to, as opposed to kids understanding that school is a place you go to ask questions that you don't know the answers to yet. School is a place where you go to struggle, and
yep.
It's okay to struggle. And struggle is a sign of progress.
And teachers will support you in your struggles.
Absolutely, absolutely. But too often, I even see it in doctoral students I work with. I teach statistics courses, and when you see someone in their 40s, highly educated, very very intelligent, very thoughtful, professionally successful, they'll raise their hand in a statistics class, and they'll apologize for asking a question, and the assumption is that they should know it all.
Yes.
Already. And if you think about how that manifests itself with an adult who has every right to be confident, we have to stand in the shoes of kids and remember, what is
Yes.
it like to be 8 years old and not know the answer, and to be sitting next to a student who does know the answer, and attributing the fact that you don't know the answer to some type of internal deficit that can't be fixed. We need to create classroom contexts where inquiry is celebrated, where asking questions is as valued as giving the right answers.
And you describe something that is much more complex than I think the average member of the community or even parent thinks schools do in terms of working with kids.
Absolutely, yeah. Class size is an interesting topic, for example.
Exactly.
The research out there on the net effect of class size, based on John Hattie's work, he's a researcher out of Australia. He does syntheses of studies, so he looks at lots and lots of research and looks at the net effect. In general, class size tends not to make that much of a difference. We're talking about like the distinction between a class of 30 and a class of 23, let's say. What matters is what strategies are utilized in that classroom.
Yes.
So a comment I've made to many parents is, you know, if I had to choose between putting my child in a classroom with 30 kids or 22 kids, there are about 99 other questions I'd want to know the answer to before I made that choice. But that's a good example. It's obvious. It seems intuitive. If there are fewer kids, it must be a better learning environment.
Well, there's a possibility
for
a better learning.
There's the potential, but the but is not based on that structure. The but is based on how does that teacher then utilize that additional time and space, as it were, to give more effective feedback to kids, to create richer and deeper learning profiles of kids, to spend more time with kids engaged in goal-setting processes, to spend more time engaged with kids on revision.
To use strategies that they couldn't use otherwise.
Exactly,
maybe.
And that's the key, strategies that they couldn't use otherwise. And oftentimes, if we are rooted in the very traditional, I give you a task, it gets graded, it comes back to you, we move on to the next thing, we're not taking advantage of that potential to really support kids where learning occurs, that notion of responding to feedback, that notion of revising one's work, that notion of the kids asking questions. The learning begins when the learner is asking questions. Learning does not begin when the teacher is asking questions.
So that calls for more individualization.
Sure.
And thus the smaller class size is the better.
If, yes, exactly. Could create the better potential.
Yes.
But in and of itself, if the same kind of deeply embedded structures of teaching and how we run a classroom, then it won't matter.
Well, it depends on what he or she does with that time.
Exactly.
Working
exactly.
with that kid.
Yeah. And that's another good example of, you know, how do we use time? You know, I've seen some schools and districts push down the path of trying to add time to the school day, which creates really significant political issues and contractual issues and school board issues and busing issues and et cetera. Well, if the goal is we want to increase student time for opportunity to learn, there are all sorts of strategies that can be utilized to build in more efficiency in how we use class time. And I think that extending the school day piece would be a really good example of is what's a more efficient use of time, spending the 2 or 3 years it might take to move forward with an initiative like that, or engaging in some focused professional development and collaborative work around how we use instructional time, how we create time on task, how we use strategies that allow for more than one voice to be active in the classroom at any given time.
Let's move on. And so tell us about a school that is closest to your full implementation of your model of what good teaching and learning should be about.
Yeah, and I think the components and the indicators and the processes that we lay out in the book, it's an ongoing process. It's not a program, but absolutely some districts that come to mind with some works where I've done schools where I've done some consulting work and with colleagues or students. Pat DeKlotz, she's superintendent in Kettle Moraine, was recently Wisconsin State Superintendent of the Year. Kettle Moraine's doing some I think really phenomenal work around personalized learning for kids, and they've engaged in some really significant innovations in some of the opportunities they've created for kids with some specialty schools, for lack of a better way to say it, but not just specialty schools in name only, schools that really truly do have a different approach than might be accessible in the more traditional school day. Joanne Sternke, who's a Stritch grad and also a recent Wisconsin State Superintendent of the Year, and Mike Cady, who's the curriculum director there, and he's the incoming superintendent there. Mike's a student of mine great thinker. They've done some really rich work around creating a standards-based learning environment and really mindful implementation of that system. There's a trap out there where some schools will go to a standards-based report card without having a standards-based system in place. And I think Pewaukee's a good example of a place that's transcended that. Northwest Allen Schools in Indiana, Chris Himsel's superintendent there, and he was just recently named the Indiana Superintendent of the Year. Been doing work out there for a number of years, and Chris and his team just really professional and professional group of teachers there, really in search of always doing things better. They've been doing some great work around curriculum development and really using assessment and rubrics and articulating quality, what does quality work look like for students. And a final piece, and this is really at the systems level, and I think it's great for the you know, people around Wisconsin to know. You know, our network of CESAs, our Collaborative Education Service Agencies, other organizations and school districts from around the country really look to Wisconsin's CESAs for their leadership. And CESA 1, led up by Mary Gavigan and my co-author of the Five Levers book, Jim Rickabaugh. He was director of the Institute at CESA 1. That's now directed by Ryan Crone, a former student of mine. And they've really been leading a regional but also a national charge on systems of personalized learning and systems of personalized learning that are really driven and aligned to the Five Levers model, where we're really starting with we need to understand who that child is a learner is as a learner. That child needs to understand who he or she is as a learner. And the goal is not for teachers to have standards and teachers to have learning goals for the day and they kind of keep them secret from the kids.
Yes.
That the goal is to empower the kids to utilize those resources, to establish goals and chart their own path. Teachers are still the arbiter of what does quality
yes.
work look like. Teachers are the resource in the room. Teachers have all sorts of expertise around strategies to move kids forward. But kids need to own the goals. And kids, when taught how to do so, can really engage in curriculum at a much deeper level when they're given some choice and voice to do so.
Because they understand what they are doing then, as opposed to doing a just rote.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
going through a textbook or whatever it might be, page by page and
right.
so on.
Yeah, there's a real critical distinction, and it seems like it's semantics, but it's not. There's a real critical distinction between, you know, what is a child doing in a classroom and what is a child learning in a classroom. And if I'm focused on what do I have to do today,
yes.
I can see school as... Today is, I do page 326, 1 through 27 odds.
Yes.
Which begs questions like, do we have to do all the way through number 27? Or if I do the evens, can I get extra credit? Or that's a real task-focused classroom. Versus why are we doing the work? The purpose of
yes.
today is to solve algebraic equations with one variable. What do you know about that as you go in? What are you learning to do next? Where are you getting stuck? That's where the learning occurs. And we have to be clear in our teaching. We have to be intentional in our teaching about why am I asking kids to do this work? And do the kids understand why they're doing the work? And that's critically important for classroom culture and critically important for improving student learning.
And that gets back to curriculum, too, because so the teacher then has to have good curriculum then that does these kinds of things or helps students do these kinds of things. And then above that, then, you have to have administrators then who know that this is what needs to be done
sure.
and structure then schools and what goes on in schools so that can be done.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I really like to think in terms of we have to be clear about assessment first before we can be clear about curriculum. And when I say we have to be clear about assessment, I don't mean what's on the state tests. I mean those internal school-created or at least school-utilized day-to-day, week-to-week classroom assessments that we can use not just to measure student learning, but also to inform teaching and learning. If we're not clear about where students are going, we can't be clear about what I should do in the classroom today. We can't be clear about what curriculum opportunities should be afforded to kids.
Okay, now we're beginning to hear what's going on in terms of repairs around here. Let's move on then to a question then. Given that you already have four published books on education, I would suspect that you're already working on number five. Are you, and what's it about? And
Yes, absolutely. And it's really related to the conversation, the topic we were just discussing, which is around assessment. And the essence of the book is around valid and reliable assessment. And again, valid and reliable classroom assessment and validity and reliability can be kind of scary psychometric terms. But at their core, are we assessing what we value most? And when I give a child an assessment task, does that give me evidence of where that child is relative to the learning goal?
Is the assessment valid?
Is the assessment valid, and can I use it in reliable ways? And again, even more deeply, does the child understand? I can do these types of questions. I can do these types of items, but I can't do these types of items yet, and here's what I'm working to do to close the gap between the two. But the assessment piece then, there really is a depth of assessment literacy that's required of classroom teachers that I think is becoming more apparent as we try to move the needle on teaching and learning in the field. Because we could have a whole separate discussion around standardized tests and state tests. And,
right.
But a piece that I always come back to is the tests that kids take 3 days a year. I understand that they are high stakes. I understand that there's a lot of politics involved. But I also understand that as a practitioner, there's not a whole lot I can do to change what's on those assessments. To those ends, I'm far more concerned about the assessments kids are taking the other 177 days a year, because we do have much more direct control over those assessments. And how are we utilizing those assessments, not just summatively, not just to evaluate or judge student learning at the end of a learning sequence? How are we using those assessments in formative ways to inform teaching, to inform what strategies should be utilized in the classroom, to inform kids' conceptions of themselves as learners, and to inform kids' understanding that you don't come to school because you know this already. You're here to learn, and we can chart your progress across a unit or a mark period or a school year. And if the kids can chart that progress and the kids can talk about that growth they're making, those kids are learning more than kids who do not have that understanding and are not afforded those opportunities.
Is that metacognition then? Is that they understand what they're learning and how they're learning and what they need to do?
Sure, but it's being metacognitive and reflective about the learning, not the task.
Yes, yes.
Right? So if I give a child a writing task and what I put in the rubric is your essay needs to be 2 pages and have 5 paragraphs and have 3 main ideas, I can cobble together an essay where I'm asking myself, okay, have I written enough yet? Okay, do I have 3 main ideas? All right, I'm done with my essay.
Yeah, I followed the formula.
Exactly. But the essence of good writing is, have I been clear? Have I supported my position. It's not just having three ideas. Do I have three ideas that are relevant to the topic at hand? And are they clear for the reader, let alone are they clear in my own mind? So it's absolutely about helping kids be metacognitive and reflective, but we want to support their efforts to be metacognitive and reflective about the quality of work, not just getting the task done.
So you'd start with the structure, though, and get the task done, the first round, and then you would build on that in terms of getting at
sure.
the refinement of
yeah.
that item.
Yeah, the structural components are often more related to the directions for the task. But the what we call rubrics, and for listeners who aren't aware, it's simply an articulation of the quality components of student
an
work.
An outline of the expectations.
Yeah, the quality components. So on the directions, I might say 2 pages, 3 main ideas, 5 paragraphs. But the essence of quality, what is going to allow me to discern a higher quality from a lesser quality piece of work, and if I'm a student, what is going to allow me to discern where do I need to edit and revise, that's going to be related to organization and sentence fluency and the depth of one's ideas.
At this point, I want to remind our listeners that this is your host, Dwayne Olson, and you're listening to Education Matters on WGTD HD at 91.1 on your radio dial from Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin. Today, I am visiting with Dr. Tony Frontier, Assistant Professor of Education at Cardinal Stritch University, Milwaukee, about his 2 recent books, or about actually his 4 recent books, as well as current developments in Wisconsin public education, with emphasis on urban education. Now back to our program. After spending a lifetime in education, one of my thoughts about improving education these days is to extend the contracts of at least half of the teachers in the public schools to full-time, the same as a full-time administrator in Wisconsin public schools. In that additional time, teachers would teach, confer with fellow teachers about their teaching, and teachers seldom get to see another teacher teach, develop curriculum, attend conferences, workshops, etc., perhaps carry out the background work that provides for the implementation of your model in their classrooms. So your reaction to my ideas. I just think teaching is so much more complex today
it is.
Than it was when I was a high school teacher.
It is, yeah. The world is a more complex place, and the amount of information that's accessible and we're expected as citizens, let alone as professionals in a field, the amount of information we're expected to deal with, it's by magnitudes of hundreds from what it was, 30 years ago, pre-internet. So I would go back. I'd put my 5 levers hat on with your suggestion, and I would respond as this: the notion of teachers need more time. I would see that as a structural component,
yes.
Right? So I know that in and of itself might not change much, might not really move the needle. But what I did like is what you said about, and how might they use that time? And that is where there really could be, with an initiative like that, some really tremendous leverage. And what that relates to is a book I did with Paul Milkey, who's a superintendent out in Hamilton Schools now and a former student of mine, that came out through ASCD in August of 2016, called Making Teachers Better, Not Bitter, Balancing Evaluation, Supervision, and Reflection. And here's how, through the lens of that book, we would take that initiative and that you mentioned and run with it. There's been a lot in the last 5 years in the field around higher stakes evaluation. And evaluation, we should be concerned, is it valid and reliable? Are we measuring the right things? Do principals or administrators in classrooms engaging in evaluation, can they produce similar results regardless of accurate results regardless of the classroom they're in? But evaluation in and of itself does nothing to improve teaching, any more so than giving a kid the SAT does anything to improve learning. What matters is, what do we do in the space when kids aren't taking that test? What do you do in the space when the principal is not in the back of the room evaluating the teacher? And that means how are we using, how are teachers using the other 177 days when the principal isn't in the back of the room? How are they using that time to get better? And what we talk about in Better Not Bitter is that we really need systems where teachers can use those frameworks for evaluation for their own formative purposes. To those ends, we need to create systems that are empowering of teachers, that give them the autonomy to chart their own growth. It needs to be focused. All sorts of research around quality goal setting, all sorts of research around expertise and what experts do to improve their practice. And teachers need to reflect in meaningful and purposeful ways, similar to what we were talking about with students earlier. Teachers need to be metacognitive, but they need to be metacognitive about the right things, and it's those components related to standards, strategy, and self. So we talk about the distinction between what we call the ABCs of justification versus being on par for reflection. And the ABCs of justification are when we fall into traps where we kind of avoid blame and complain about why the system isn't working or why kids aren't learning, versus being on par, purposeful, aware, responsive within the classroom. So here's how I would use that additional time that you mentioned. Among the most powerful sets of strategies we have to move the needle on student learning is facilitating opportunities for teachers to develop what John Hattie calls collaborative expertise. So teaching is an incredibly isolated profession.
Yes.
And what we know from Anders Ericsson's work around experts spend a whole lot of time watching others engaged in their craft. Experts spend a whole lot of time working with coaches. Experts spend a lot of time engaged in goal setting, where they're in pursuit of getting even better, not just in areas where they already feel pretty good. Those areas are fun to build capacity in, but areas where they struggle. So to create contexts and opportunities where teachers can visit one another's classrooms,
yes,
not for purposes of evaluation, but for purposes of their own reflection, where teachers can sit down with one another and look at student assessments and talk about what patterns do we see. Your students did well in this area. Let's talk about how do you teach that? I don't teach it that
yes.
way. To spend time building quality assessments, to spend time revising curriculum and pulling resources together. If that's how teachers could spend that time, it would be a very powerful investment, but that notion of really tapping into collective expertise, it would pay off, I've no doubt in my mind.
Okay, with that background, about how to improve K-12 education, let's suppose that you are the czar of education in Wisconsin. What would you do about public education in Wisconsin to make it better? And what would you do as state superintendent of public instruction?
If I could wave a wand.
Yeah, if you could wave a magic wand.
Yeah, it really would come down to starting with quality classroom assessments and ensuring that teachers and kids were clear about what is it that we're working toward. What are the skills, the strategies, the content that is most important? Because we have to prioritize. We have to prioritize. If everything's important, nothing's important.
Right.
Understanding takes time. Learning takes time. If we're rushing through to cover content, kids aren't learning. They might do well enough on an assessment after 2 weeks, but it's not going to stick. So I would create enough time in the school day for teachers to engage in a lot of collaborative practices. I would want to ensure there were high levels of trust within schools, and a belief, an understanding that teaching is a really complex profession, and to attain expertise in teaching really does require an entire career's worth of work and effort. Tenure and expertise have nothing to do with each other, and I think that's a mistake that we've made. The best teachers I know, talk to them at their retirement party, and they'll tell you things that they're still learning and still wish they knew about right. How to best support student learning. So it, at its core, it would come down to quality assessments, being clear about a few prioritized learning goals that were manageable to teach for depth, and teachers would have the strategies in place to help support student learning to those ends, and kids would see themselves as their own best teacher. Kids would understand that learning is an active, engaged process, and the resources that we use in classrooms to support student learning, to measure student learning, they're not just there for the adults, but ultimately they're there for the students to use to guide their own work and guide their own thinking.
And if we back up, then we would have the principal then would be the person then who could work with teachers to assure that this was being done, or principals and somebody else working in the school dealing with curriculum.
Sure, yes. You absolutely need people to help facilitate those processes. And really at the core, if we have sound assessments in place, if we have good curriculum in place, you know, it's really the teacher's responsibility to tend to those components related to structure, to tend to those more political components, to tend to what I really see as adult needs in the school, to get those off the plates of teachers so teachers can, and teachers need to make a choice to do this as well, to really focus on kids and learning and not be distracted by some of those bigger political pieces that are spinning out there. There's a time and a place to tend to those, but it's not in the classroom during the school day.
To our radio audience, we say thank you for being with us today as we visited with Dr. Tony Frontier, Assistant Professor of Education at Cardinal Stritch University, Milwaukee, about current developments in Wisconsin public education with emphasis on urban education. Tony, I wish you well in your task of preparing teachers and administrators for Wisconsin schools. It seems to me that you really have a lot to offer all of us. Yours is a most important endeavor for our students, our citizens, our state. And thank you for sharing your knowledge through your four books. And good luck to you in your ongoing work. This is your host, Dwayne Olson, thanking you for being with us today.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Outhouse, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. Allow the compassionate, caring staff at Piasecki Outhouse to take care of your funeral needs, serving the community since 1931.
Support comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, back outside on 2nd Avenue and Plaza Douay with dozens of vendors, including La Tarte Bakery, offering a delectable selection of cookies, bars, mini pies, mini breads, and more. The market's open Saturdays from 9 until 2.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's. Join their summer cigar events happening every other Thursday on the patio. Take advantage of great deals, enjoy a top-rated cigar, and relax with friends. Visit andreasgifts.com for the complete schedule. Andrea's, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes,
jazz, swing, blues, bop, and more from WGTD is available 24 hours a day on your desktop or laptop, smartphone, or radio. To access 24/7 jazz WGTD on your computer, go to WGTD.org. On your smartphone, download the free WGTD app. In the Kenosha Racine area, 24/7 Jazz HD2 is available via HD radio. And in the Waukegan and Pleasant Prairie areas, the service is being broadcast temporarily over analog radio at 103.3 FM. For more information, call 262-564-3030.
She walks at the sea.